He moved them from laughter to tears, from sorrow to shame. Great waves of the corresponding colors seemed to go over the whole audience, as bewildering as they were magnificent. Then there were the customary calls to stand up for Jesus, the invitation to the mourner's bench, etc., and each brought forth from all over the audience a certain emotional response which was plainly shown in colors, golden and blue. Then there were more songs, more clappings and gesticulations which, for the time, furthered the unity and gave this audience an experience resembling the feeling of universal brotherhood and the reality of the fatherhood of God. The only ones upon whom the music had no effect were the men clad in the steel blue armor of fear. This color seems to be almost impervious to any other emotion, and even though the feelings experienced by the great majority were relatively impermanent, the people benefited in a measure by the revival, with the exception of these men of steel. So far as the writer has been able to learn, the inner fear of yielding to emotion, fear being saturnine in effect and twin sister to worry, seems to require a shock that will take the person so affected out of his environment and set him down in a new place among new conditions before the old conditions can be overcome. Worry is a condition where the desire currents do not sweep in long curved lines in any part of the desire body, but where the vehicle is full of eddies, nothing but eddies in extreme cases. The person so affected does not endeavor to take action in any line. He sees calamities where there are none, and instead of generating currents which lead to action that may prevent the thing he fears, each thought of worry causes an eddy in the desire body, and he does nothing in consequence. This condition of worry in the desire body may be likened to water which is about to congeal under a lowering temperature. Fear which expresses itself as skepticism, cynicism, and pessimism may be likened to that same water when it has frozen, for the desire bodies of such people are almost motionless, and nothing one can say or do seems to have the power to alter the condition. They have, to use a common expression which fits the condition excellently, drawn into a shell, and that saturnine shell must be broken before it is possible to get at the man and help him out of his pitiable state. These saturnine emotions of fear and worry are usually caused by the sufferer's apprehension of economic or social difficulties. Perhaps this investment which I have made may depreciate or become a total loss. I may lose my position and find myself starving upon the street. Everything I undertake seems to go wrong. My neighbors are slandering me and trying to undermine my social position. My husband, or wife, does not care for me anymore. My children are neglecting me, and a thousand and one kindred suggestions present themselves to the mind. He should remember that every time one of these thoughts is indulged in, it helps to congeal the currents in the desire body and build a steel blue shell in which the person who habitually fosters fear and worry will sometime find himself shut off from the love, sympathy, and help of all the world. Therefore, we ought to strive to be cheerful, even under adverse circumstances, or we may find ourselves in a serious condition here and hereafter. In the beginning of the Great War, the emotions of Europe ran riot in a most horrible manner, first among the so-called living, and then among the killed, when they awoke. This awakening took a long time because of the large guns used, but more of that later. The whole atmosphere of the countries involved was seething with currents of anger and hate. Like a cloud of dark crimson it hung around every human being and over the land. Then there were dark, tinted streaks like a funeral pall, which seems always to be generated in crises of sudden disaster when reason is at a standstill and despair grips the heart. This was undoubtedly caused by the fact that the peoples involved realized that a catastrophe of a magnitude which they were unable to comprehend was happening. The desire bodies of the majority whirled at high speed in long waves of rhythmic pulsation which said more plainly than words, just kill, kill, kill. When two or three or a crowd met and commenced to discuss the war, the rhythmic pulsations indicating the settled purpose to do and dare ceased, and the thoughts and feelings of excitement generated by the discussion or speech took shape as conical projections which rapidly grew to a height of about 6 or 8 inches, then they burst and emitted a tongue of flame. Some people generated a number of these volcanic structures at one time, In others there were only one or two at the same time. When one of these bubbles had burst in one place, another appeared somewhere else, and while the discussion lasted, and it was the flames from them that colored the cloud over the land scarlet. When a crowd disbanded or friends parted after such a discussion, the bubbling and eruptions grew smaller and less frequent, finally ceasing and giving place again to the long rhythmic pulsations first mentioned. These conditions are now, 1916, seldom if ever seen. The explosive anger at the enemy thus indicated is a thing of the past so far as the great majority are concerned. The basic orange color of the Western people's aura is again visible, and both officers and men seem to have settled down to war as to a game. Each is anxious to outdo and outwit the other. The war is now mainly a channel for their ingenuity, but a number of the lay brothers of the Rosicrucian order believe that the condition of anger will return in a modified form when active hostilities cease and peace negotiations commence. This form of emotion we may call abstract anger, and it differs widely from what is observed in the case of two persons who become angry with each other in private life, whether they start to fight physically or not. Seen from the hidden side of nature, there are hostilities before blows are struck. Jagged, dagger-like desire forms project themselves from one to the other like spears until the fury which generated them has expended itself. In the patriotic anger there is no personal enemy, therefore the desire forms are more blunt and explode without leaving the person who generated them. The steel men so common in private life where worry over the thousand and one things that never happen crystallizes an armor around the person who allows old Saturn thus to grip him, wherein they are conspicuous by their absence. The writer accounts for it on the hypothesis that the tension in their environment forced them to enlist and the shock broke the shell, then familiarity with danger bred contempt for it. It is certain that these people have benefited greatly by the war, for there is no state more hampering to soul growth than constant fear and worry. It is also a remarkable fact that though the men engaged in war suffer awful privations, the mass of them are cultivating a tinge of soft sky blue which stands for hope, optimism, and a dawning religious feeling, giving an altruistic touch to the character. It is an indication that that universal fellow feeling which knows no distinctions of creed, color, or country is growing in the human heart. The red cloud of hate is lifting, the black veil of despair is gone, there are no volcanic outbursts of passion in either the living or the dead, but so far as the writer is able to read the signs of the times in the aura of the nations, there is a settled purpose to play the game to the end. Even in homes bereaved of many members, this seems to hold good. There is an intense longing for the friends beyond but no hatred for the earthly foe. This longing is shared by the friends in the unseen and many are piercing the veil, for the intensity of their longing is awakening in the dead the power to manifest by attracting a quantity of ether and gas which often is taken from the vital body of a sensitive friend, as materializing spirits use the vital body of an entranced medium. Thus the eyes blinded by tears are often opened by a yearning heart so that loved ones now in the spirit world are met again face to face, heart to heart. This is nature's method of cultivating the sixth sense which will eventually enable all to know that man is an immortal spirit and continuity of life a fact in nature. Chapter 4. Influence of Thought. It is a law in the desire world that as a man thinketh, so is he, literally and without qualification. A dense body formed of the inert substance of the chemical region, quickened and vitalized by the vital body composed of the ethers of the etheric region, receives the incentive to action from the desire body, an incentive which the animals follow absolutely, but which in man is checked by another factor, reason, which sometimes causes him to act contrary to desire. Were there no other realms in nature but the physical world and the desire world, that factor would be non-existent. We could have mineral, plant and animal, but man, a thinking, reasoning being, would be an impossibility in nature. We, ourselves, as egos, function directly in the subtle substance of the region of abstract thought, which we have specialized within the periphery of our individual aura. Thence we view the impressions made by the outer world upon the vital body through the senses, together with the feelings and emotions generated by them in the desire body, and mirrored in the mind. From these mental images we form our conclusions, in the substance of the region of abstract thought, concerning the subjects with which they deal. These conclusions are ideas. By the power of will we project an idea through the mind, where it takes concrete shape as a thought form by drawing mind stuff around itself from the region of concrete thought. The mind is like the projecting lens of a stereopticon. It projects the image in one of three directions, according to the will of the thinker, which ensouls the thought form. 1. It may be projected against in an endeavor to arouse feeling which will lead to immediate action. A. If the thought awakens interest, one of the twin forces, attraction or repulsion, will be stirred up. If attraction, the centripetal force, is aroused, it seizes the thought, whirls it into the desire body, endows the image with added life and clothes it with desire stuff. Then the thought is able to act on the etheric brain, and propel the vital force through the appropriate brain centers and nerves to the voluntary muscles which perform the necessary action. Thus the force in the thought is expended and the image remains in the ether of the vital body as memory of the act and the feeling that caused it. B. Repulsion is the centrifugal force, and if that is aroused by the thought, there will be a struggle between the spiritual force, the will of the man, within the thought form, and the desire body. This is the battle between conscience and desire, the higher and the lower nature. The spiritual force, in spite of resistance, will seek to clothe the thought form in the desire stuff needed to manipulate the brain and muscles. The force of repulsion will endeavor to scatter the appropriated material and oust the thought. If the spiritual energy is strong, it may force its way through to the brain centers and hold its clothing of desire stuff, while manipulating the vital force, thus compelling action, and will then leave upon the memory a vivid impression of the struggle and the victory. If the spiritual energy is exhausted before action has resulted, it will be overcome by the force of repulsion, and will be stored in the memory, as are all other thought forms when they have expended their energy. We have in our body two nervous systems, the voluntary and the involuntary. The first named is operated directly by the desire body, and controls the movements of the body, tends to break down and destroy, only partially restrained in its ruthless task by the mind. It is this war between the vital body and the desire body which produces consciousness in the physical world, but did not the mind act as a brake on the desire body, our waking hours would be very short. So would our lives, for the vital body would soon be overridden in its beneficent offices by the reckless desire body, as evidenced in the exhaustion which follows a fit of temper. Temper is a condition where the man has lost control and the desire body rules unchecked. Disease takes many forms. One is insanity, and that also is of different kinds. Where the connection between the sense centers of the dense body and the vital body is askew, where sometimes the head of the vital body towers above the dense head instead of being concentric with it, the vital body is out of adjustment with both the higher vehicles and the dense body. Then we have the docile idiot. Where the dense and vital bodies are in adjustment but the break is between the vital body and the desire body, a similar condition obtains, but when the break is between and the mind we have the raving maniac, who is more ungovernable than a wild animal, for that is checked by the group spirit. In that case all the animal propensities are followed blindly. The natural tendency of is to harden and consolidate all it comes into contact with. Materialistic thought accentuates this tendency to such an extent that it very often results, in succeeding lives, in that dread disease, consumption, which is a hardening of the lungs. These should remain soft and elastic. It also sometimes happens that crushes the vital body in the next life, so that it fails altogether to counteract the hardening process, and then we have quick consumption. In some cases materialism makes brittle, as it were. Then it cannot perform its proper hardening work on the dense body, and as a result we have rachitis, where the bones soften. So we see what dangers we run by entertaining materialistic tendencies, either hardening of the soft parts of the body, as in consumption, or softening of the hard bony parts, as in rachitis. Of course, not every case of consumption shows that the sufferer was materialistic in a former life, but it is the teaching of occult science that such a result often follows materialism. Our thoughts are of vastly more importance than our acts, for if we will only think right, we shall always act right. No man can think love to his fellow man, can scheme in his mind how to aid and help them, spiritually, mentally, or physically, without also acting out these thoughts at some time in his life, and if we will only cultivate such thoughts, we shall soon find sunshine spreading around us. We shall find that people will meet us in that same spirit. Influence of thought that we send out, and if we would realize that the desire body, which surrounds each of us and extends about 16 to 18 inches beyond the periphery of the physical body, contains all these feelings and emotions, we would meet people differently. Then we would understand that everything we see is viewed through the atmosphere we have created around ourselves, which colors all we behold in others. If the astronomer exercises his will and focuses the telescope as he desires, telling it to attend to its business of transmitting the rays that strike it, leaving the results to him, the work will proceed well. But if the lens has the stronger will and the mechanism of the telescope is in league with it, the astronomer will be seriously hampered in having to contend with a refractory instrument, and the result will be blurred pictures, of little or no value. Thus it is with the ego. It works with a threefold body, which it controls, or should control through the mind. But, sad to say, this body has a will of its own and is often aided and abetted by the mind, thus frustrating the purposes of the ego. This antagonistic lower will is an expression of the higher part of the desire body. When the division of the sun, moon, and earth took place, in the early part of the Lemurian epoch, the more advanced portion of humanity in the making experienced a division of into a higher and a lower part. The rest of humanity did likewise in the early part of the Atlantean epoch. This higher part of became a sort of animal soul. It built the cerebrospinal nervous system and the voluntary muscles, by that means controlling the lower part of the threefold body until the link of mind was given. Then the mind coalesced with this animal soul and became a co-regent. The mind is thus bound up in desire, is enmeshed in the selfish lower nature, making it difficult for the spirit to control the body. The focusing mind, which should be the ally of the higher nature, is alienated by and in league with the lower nature, enslaved by desire. The law of the race religions was given to emancipate intellect from desire. The fear of God was pitted against the desires of the flesh. This, however, was not enough to enable one to become master of the body and secure its will incorporation. It became necessary for the spirit to find in the body another point of vantage, which was not under the sway of the desire nature. All muscles are expressions of and a straight road to the capital, where the traitorous mind is wedded to desire and reigns supreme. Chapter 5, Relationship to Consciousness. To understand the degree of consciousness which results from the possession of the vehicles used by the life evolving in the four kingdoms, we turn our attention to Diagram 4, which shows that man, the ego, the thinker, has descended into the chemical region of the physical world. Here he has marshaled all his vehicles, thereby attaining the state of waking consciousness. He is learning to control his vehicles. The organs of neither the desire body nor the mind are yet evolved. The latter is not yet even a body. At present it is simply a link, a sheath for the use of the ego as a focusing point. It is the last of the vehicles that have been built. The spirit works gradually from finer into coarser substance, the vehicles also being built in fine substance first, then in coarser and coarser substance. The dense body was built first and has now come into its fourth stage of density. The vital body is in its third stage, is in its second, hence it is still cloud-like, and the sheath of mind is filmier still, as those vehicles have not, as yet, evolved any organs. It is clear that they alone would be useless as vehicles of consciousness. The ego, however, enters into the dense body and connects these organless vehicles with the physical sense centers and thus attains the waking state of consciousness in the physical world. 57. The student should particularly note that it is because of their connection with the splendidly organized mechanism of the dense body that these higher vehicles become of value at present. He will thus avoid a mistake frequently made by people who, when they come into the knowledge that there are higher bodies, grow to despise the dense body, to speak of it as low and vile, turning their eyes to heaven and wishing that they might soon be able to leave this earthly lump of clay and fly about in their higher vehicles. Strange as the statement may seem, it is nevertheless true that the great majority of mankind are partially asleep most of the time, notwithstanding the fact that their physical bodies may seem to be intensely occupied in active work. Under ordinary conditions, in the case of the great majority, is the most awake part of composite man, who lives almost entirely in his feelings and emotions, but scarcely ever thinks of the problem of existence beyond what is necessary to keep body and soul together. Most of this class have probably never given the great questions of life: whence have we come, why are we here, and whither are we going, any serious consideration. Their vital bodies are kept active, repairing the ravages of upon the physical vehicle, and purveying the vitality which is later dissipated in gratifying the desires and emotions. It is this hard-fought battle between the vital and desire bodies which generates consciousness in the physical world and makes men and women so intensely alert that, viewed from the standpoint of the physical world, it seems to give the lie to our assertion that they are partially asleep. Nevertheless, upon examination of all the facts, it will be found that this is the case, and we may also say that this state of affairs has come about by the design of the great hierarchs who have our evolution in charge. The particular stronghold of is in the muscles and the cerebrospinal nervous system. The energy displayed by a person when laboring under great excitement or anger is an example of this. At such times the whole muscular system is tense, and no hard labor is so exhausting as a fit of temper. It sometimes leaves the body prostrated for weeks. There can be seen the necessity for improving by controlling the temper, thus sparing the dense body the suffering resulting from the ungoverned action of the desire body. Looking at the matter from an occult standpoint, all consciousness in the physical world is the result of the constant war between the desire and the vital bodies. The tendency of the vital body is to soften and build. Its chief expression is the blood and the glands, also the sympathetic nervous system, having obtained ingress into the stronghold of the muscular and the voluntary nervous systems, when it began to develop the heart into a voluntary muscle. The tendency of is to harden, and it in turn has invaded the realm of the vital body, gaining possession of the spleen and making the white blood corpuscles, which are not the policemen of the system as science now thinks, but destroyers. It uses the blood to carry these tiny destroyers all over the body. They pass through the walls of arteries and veins whenever annoyance is felt, and especially in times of great anger. Then the rush of forces in makes the arteries and veins swell and opens the way for the passage of the white blood corpuscles into the tissues of the body, where they form basis for the earthly matter which kills the body. During the waking state there is a constant war between the vital body and the desire body. The desires and impulses from are constantly impinging upon the dense body, impelling it to action, regardless of any damage resulting to the latter instrument, so that desire is gratified. It is the desire vehicle that urges the drunkard to fill his system with liquor, so that the chemical combustion of spirit may raise the vibrations of the dense body to such a pitch as to make it the willing tool of every mad impulse, wasting its stored energy with reckless prodigality. Is the vehicle of our emotions, feelings, and desires which expends the energies in the dense body by the vital processes through control of the cerebrospinal or voluntary nervous system. In its activities, this desire body is constantly destroying and breaking down tissue built by the vital body, and it is the war between these two vehicles which causes what we call consciousness in the physical world. The etheric forces in the vital body act in such a manner that they convert as much of the food as possible into the blood, and this is the highest expression of the vital body. The spleen is the gateway of the vital body. There the solar force which abounds in the surrounding atmosphere enters in a constant stream, to aid us in the vital processes, and there also the war between and there. vital body is waged most fiercely. Thoughts of worry, fear, and anger interfere with the processes of evaporation in the spleen. A speck of plasm is the result, and this is at once seized upon by a thought elemental which forms a nucleus and embodies itself therein. Then it commences to live a life of destruction, coalescing with other waste products and decaying elements wherever formed, making the body a charnel house instead of the temple of an indwelling living spirit. This destruction is constantly going on, and it is not possible to keep all the destroyers out, nor is such the intention. If the vital body had uninterrupted sway, it would build and build, using all the energy for that purpose. There would be no consciousness and thought. It is because checks and hardens the inner parts that consciousness develops. As has been previously explained, is an unorganized ovoid, holding the dense body as a dark spot within its center, as the white of an egg surrounds the yolk. There are a number of sense centers in the ovoid, which have appeared since the beginning of the Earth period. In the average human being, these centers appear merely as eddies in a current and are not now awake. Hence his desire body is of no use to him as a separate vehicle of consciousness, but when the sense centers are awakened they look like whirling vortices. Chapter 6. During sleep. The desire world is an ocean of wisdom and harmony. Into this the ego takes the mind, and when the lower vehicles have been left in sleep, there the first care of the ego is the restoration of the rhythm and harmony of the mind and the desire body. This restoration is accomplished gradually as the harmonious vibrations of the desire world flow through them. There is an essence in the desire world corresponding to the vital fluid which permeates the dense body by means of the vital body. The higher vehicles, as it were, steep themselves in this elixir of life. When strengthened, they commence work on the vital body, which was left with the sleeping dense body. Then the vital body begins to specialize the solar energy anew, rebuilding the dense body, using particularly the chemical ether as its medium in the process of restoration. It happens, however, that at times does not fully withdraw, so that part of it remains connected with the vital body, the vehicle for sense perception and memory. The result is that restoration is only partly accomplished, and that the scenes and actions of the desire world are brought into the physical consciousness as dreams. Of course, most dreams are confused as the axis of perception is askew, because of the improper relation of one body to another. The memory is also confused by this incongruous relation of the vehicles, and as a result of the loss of the restoring force, dream-filled sleep is restless and the body feels tired on awakening. What is it that makes sleep a restorative state? In the very term restorative there is implied an activity. If a building is to be restored, it is necessary that the tenants move out, and that wear and tear cease. But that is not enough. Workmen must be brought in to repair the damage incident to the use of the building. Only when that work has been done is restoration complete and the building ready for reoccupancy by the tenants. So also with the temple of the ego, our dense body, when that has been exhausted. It is then necessary that the ego, mind, and desire body vacate and give the vital body full sway, that it may restore the tone of the dense body, and thus, when the dense body goes to sleep, there is a separation. The ego and the mind, clothed in the desire body, draw out from the vital body and the dense body, the two latter remaining on the bed, while the higher vehicles hover above or near the sleeping body. The process of restoration now begins. In a fight in the physical world, the injuries are never all on one side, the winner always has some lesions. The fiercer the fight, and the more evenly the combatants are matched, the more lesions go to each. So with the combating vital and desire bodies, wins every time, yet its victory is always a defeat, for it is then forced to leave the battlefield and the prize, the dense body, in the hands of the vanquished vital body, and withdraw to repair its own shattered harmony. When it withdraws from the sleeping body, it enters that sea of force and harmony called the desire world. Here it lives over the scenes of the day, but in reverse order, from effects to causes, straightening out the tangles of the day, forming true pictures to replace the wrong impressions due to the limitations of the life in the dense body, and as the harmonies of the desire world pervade it, and wisdom and truth replace error, it regains its rhythm and its tone, the time required to restore it varying according to how elusive, impulsive, and strenuous had been the life of the day.